hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Daggers and Lids podcast. I'm Charles Dagnall here in a hotel in Malaysia. Yes, I am here ahead of the Women's T20 Under-19 World Cup, which starts tomorrow. Goodness me, that's worrying, Lydia. And you have got up all sleepy-eyed, although you did say you got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to record this. So 6:30 a.m. UK time. It's around about 2:30 in the afternoon Malaysia time. How are you? We are recording this, around about 40 minutes after the conclusion of England's defeat in the third one-day international of the Women's Ashes over at the Ninja Stadium in Hobart. So firstly, how are you? You look a little bleary-eyed, and that's not in a bad way, but it's understandable.
I am slightly bleary-eyed, I have to admit. Although, I have been able to get up, wash my hair and put a bit of makeup on just to make myself slightly more presentable than I was a couple of hours ago.
Let's do that all again. Okay, here we go. Lydia, you look sensational for 6:30 in the morning, so I can dig myself out of the enormous hole that I've just dug. But it is at the conclusion. Everything is very, very fresh in our memories. So we'll talk a little bit about the Under-19 World Cup later on and any bits of news. But the big stories at this moment is that the one-day international series has been completed. Australia have whitewashed England 3-0. Firstly at the North Sydney Oval, then onto the Junction Oval, and 40 minutes or so ago. They defeated England quite comfortably in the end, after getting a score of 300+, this after they were struggling. They won the toss, elected to bat. They were 4 down for around about 60. And then Ash Gardner got her first ever ODI century for Australia. Half centuries for Beth Mooney and Talia McGrath. In response, England flattered to deceive, some decent partnerships, but they were rolled out for 2-2-2. Alana King picking up her best one-day international figures, I think, of she picked up 5 wickets. Lydia, fresh in the memory, overriding thoughts of the series as a whole, first off.
Yeah, hugely disappointing, to be honest, Aggers. I think this is the most disappointed I've been with the performances of an England side for a long, long time. And I think we're beyond the point now of looking at it game by game in the cricket and what we've seen. I'm sure that is what we will talk about first. Mm. But actually, I think you have to look beyond that. You have to look at why England have not been able to compete against a side who have the same resources. England and Australia both have the best structures in world cricket. Talent is not a question. We've never questioned the talent. But I think one thing you and I have always said, and we've always sung the praises of England teams when they win the bilateral series. You know, they've just been to South Africa. They play really well. Of course they did, and they won. But we only ever know where this England side is when they come up against Australia, who, as I say, have got exactly the same resources. So for me, Daggers, it's beyond the cricket now. I think we have to delve deeper into why have England not been able to compete, even closely. I know there were a few positives today, but I don't know what your thoughts are on that. But I'm genuinely worried now about the future of this side.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and the reasoning behind, I think it is a mentality thing. And you're right, we do sing the praises, and they've earned those praises, and not that they're looking for praise from us, but what I'm saying is that when you go over, but it's very well winning these bilateral series, and I mentioned on the last podcast, it's about being standing up when it matters, when it counts in world competitions and in Women's Ashes. And I look at this Australian side and I look at the mentality and I look at their ruthlessness and I look at England's, and, you know, we talked last time and it was mentioned about things like fitness and stuff like that. And I think there is a modicum of truth to that. I don't think it's the wholehearted reason. I think it's a mental thing. It's the fact that Australia are ruthless in whichever game. They have been ruthless for a decade, and it's been you know, or probably over a decade. And it's the way you win. And what I mean by that is that, and there's a couple of examples. I go back to the World T20 just recently over in Dubai. And it was a quote that Heather Knight came out, and you know, she might not, you know, like me delving too deep into what she said, but there was a quote that, that said, you know, we didn't qualify for the semi-finals because of a sloppy 10 overs against the West Indies. That's not true for me. They didn't qualify because even if they'd have lost against the West Indies, they needed to go and hammer Bangladesh in that first game. You have got to go and win, and win well. You've got to know and have that mentality of, we are going to, we are better than this side. We are going to destroy this side. That's the mentality that Australia have. And I don't think England do. And I think that, you know, had you gone and beaten Bangladesh, and I'm going over old ground, but it's pertinent to the kind of mentality that I think England need to go in with, or need to try and adopt, that you go in and you smash that and you go and get your net run rate high. And then you go and get your net run rate high against the next opposition. And if you have a shocker against the West Indies, you still qualify for the semi-finals, and then it's knockout cricket. And so anything can then happen. I look at Pakistan and the series over in the UK. They, you know, the first two T20s, England were sloppy. You know, they should be coming over. Pakistan is a side we should be hammering. Not just winning, hammering. And I think it's the way that you win that builds that ruthlessness, and it builds that that something inside that, that's, you know, has that mentality of Australia. They do. They feel that they should and would beat anybody. And I think that's the sort of hurdle England have got to try and get over. How you do that? Well, I think you win in a certain way. But, you know, we have seen in, you know, a number of situations. I agree, you've got to have fun on the field. Yes, absolutely. And I see that, you know, but when we see laughing and joking when catches go down, or, you know, smiles on the face, that doesn't, to me, it doesn't look, A, it doesn't look great, but B, I think that a happy side is a winning side. And a dominant side. And that's, you know, it was interesting. I looked at Australia's post-match interview. Sorry, Lydia, I'll stop in a second. I'm just looking, and because it's fresh in the memory. It was amazing. They've won 3-0. There was no, you know, overjoyedness from the Australians. It was business. It was business as usual. We've not done anything yet. We've won 3-0, but there's still 10 points to play for. There's still three T20s and a test match. And you know what? This is what came over to me in how they sounded, was that, you know what? We want to dominate those and we want to win everything. And we won't be satisfied until we do that. And I think that's the difference between the two sides.
And that all comes down to standards, I think. You talk about the ruthlessness that Australia have got. That is because they hold themselves to an impeccable level of standards on and off the pitch. And you've mentioned the messaging. That was one thing I was going to talk about, was the messaging that has come out of both camps, particularly after the first ODIs, could not be more different. You have England who are saying they're not far off. They need to be braver. They need to be more fearless. And then you have Australia. I listened to Elise Perry. She said it's winning ODI cricket is a fine line between being positive and taking responsibility. And not one time this tour have we heard an England player talk about taking responsibility. Unfortunately, in ODI cricket, there is no shortcut to being good at that format. T20, you can get away with it a bit more. But yeah, it's frustrating, and I agree with you, Daggers. I think that ruthlessness at the moment with England is not there. There's only a handful of players who I think would get into that Australian team. Nat Siverbrant, Sophie Eccleston. I'm open to who else would get into that Australian team.
Well, it's interesting with what you say. And I think I listened to the sort of message. I mean, there's that word again, this brave, this. If I hear it again, how many times have I said, "Oh, she's very brave to do this," or "We're trying to be brave"? And forget that. Play the situation. You're all vastly experienced cricketers. That top order, bar Bouchier, is pretty much 30 something, and have got an absolute wealth of international experience. When you think of Amy Jones and Nat Siver-Brunt and Heather Knight and Tammy Beaumont and Danny Wyatt-Hodge, that, I mean, you think those five, they have been around the block a long time. You know, this whole concept of, you know, trying to take on a different way or being brave, or just play the game, play the situation. Yeah. You know, what impressed me a little bit more today was their approach against spin. Certainly, yeah. I think the sweeps and the paddles and all of that was very good. I mean, obviously, you know, there's been some question marks about the way that they've played spin in the first two one-day internationals. Still, when you look at some of the dismissals, still think some of them were soft today. And, you know, trying to work balls away that are against the spin, which is fine. And I get that with a cross bat, but not necessarily when you're coming down and playing with a straight bat. So there's that element of it too. I thought they had a sort of better plan today with the bat, but I think it was a slightly better surface to bat on than we've had in the first two. But let's go back a little bit. Let's start in that first one day internationals, and I don't know about you, Lyd, and you'll be able to tell me this far better than I would from a fielding standpoint, but from a bowler's perspective, you know, the first thing I jumped to in that first one-day international was the fielding, and was the catching, and the ones and the body language subsequently, and it just felt, it almost felt like, oh no, oh dear, this is yeah. You know, it sets the tone. I think a lot of it in that first one-day international sets the tone, and already Australia are ahead when you're shelling catches left, right, and centre, and some very, very easy ones. You know, it's not as easy as sort of saying, well, they should take more catches in practice. What seems to be the problem? Because we saw it over in that game. I mentioned the West Indies T20. How many catches did they put down in that final group game against the West Indies? So there's something's wrong somewhere.
Yeah. You sound like a police officer when you say, what seems to be the problem? Or maybe that's the person getting arrested. What seems to be the problem? Fielding for me is time on task. Again, there's no shortcut to getting good at fielding, and that's the same for batting and bowling as well. I think a lot of it comes from within when you're training. I think you have to push yourself into a mentality where you're training at 110, 120% rather than just going through the motions. Now, I've not seen England train for a while. I wasn't out in South Africa. I've not been able to go and watch the intensity at which they train with. But so much of it, I think, comes down to fundamentals and basics. So how well you move, is your footwork good enough? If you're not fit enough, you can't move as efficiently. So you can't get to balls which fitter people might get to. Technique, I think, is a big one. When you look at the catch that went down, I think it was Alice Capsey off Elise Perry. Yeah. And I felt for Lauren Filer because she bowled brilliantly. It was a bouncer. Perry hooked it and it went straight to Alice Capsey. And I think low hands when you're taking high catches, if you look at the percentage of dropped catches, it's often because your hands are below your eye line because you've not tracked it all the way in. And I think that's what happened with Alice Capsey. So, yeah, I don't know, Daggers, but that's all I would say is time on task and are the basics good enough? Because at times they haven't been. And that's the same for batting and bowling. But I can imagine as a fast bowler, when you've just busted a gut to create an opportunity, because then Lauren Filer went for 19 off the next over, didn't she? And I just thought, oh, gosh, you know. And as you say, the body language then shifts.
It sucks the air out of a side, it really does, especially some of the goobers and that, you know, that specific one was. And then I know I'm flitting between the first one day or in the third, but we have just witnessed three sensational pieces of fielding from Australia in Phoebe Litchfield and Kim Garth, and then a brilliant piece of boundary work from Ash Gardner. That's a huge difference now, whether it's athleticism, whether it's technique, I don't know, but they don't seem to put them down. They don't. They seem to they seem to stick, and for England, it seems like they're a little butterfingered. That first one-day international, and if you were to look at the scorecard alone, England were rolled for 204, Danny Wyatt-Hodge with 38 and Heather Knight with 39, and then Australia 206 for 6. It sounds like it was a sort of tense game. It wasn't. To be perfectly honest, Australia had the winning of that. Alyssa Healy made 70. Ash Gardner was 42, not out. And they actually won it. And that tells it all I need to know, really, is that there was 11.1 overs remaining that Australia knocked them off. They always looked pretty comfortable in that. The frustration for England was getting starts and then not kicking on. So that was the first one-day international at the North Sydney Oval. In the second, there was sort of a glimmer of hope. England bowled really, really well. They bowled Australia out for 180, and this was after Australia were 91 for 1. And then the bowlers as a unit really did well. It was Sophie Eccleston with 4 for 35. Alice Capsey with her off-spin took 3 for 22 on a pitch that was offering a little bit of turn at the Junction Oval. England made Australia pay 180 all out in 44 overs. And then England women were bowled out for 159. Nat Silverbrunt with 35. Amy Jones with 47 not out off 103 deliveries. And that sounds like a lot, but she was doing a lot of shepherding of the tail. But then, at the back end of that second one-day international, a calamitous mix-up, which meant that Amy Jones, who was, you know, you've got to be aware of the match situation. I'm sorry you do. And this is professional cricket, and this is a women's Ashes. And if you don't know that you have got to be on strike for the next ball of the subsequent over because you're batting with Lauren Bell, then it blows my mind. And especially off a free hit. And Lauren Bell faces up to the beginning of the next over when there's 20 to win. And, you know, as the senior player in that partnership, we've said it. I have to say, we have said it before again with Amy Jones and the match awareness thing. But you've got to know that you've got to be on strike one way or another. And I don't mind getting run out for you trying to do that because you know that you've got to be the batter that wins the game for England. But rolled out for 159, 3 wickets for Kim Garth and 4 wickets for Alana King. And again, it's these mental mistakes in those first two one-day internationals.
Yeah, and again, I think that reflects, because again, you can look at these in moments, just one ball moments where you think, oh, she wasn't switched on that ball. But suddenly when those one ball moments are happening all over the place, drop catches, poor shot selection, not reading the situation, that's when you're thinking, okay, we're not where we need to be as a side. And that showed, I think, in that moment, in that second ODI, it really showed that England just couldn't grab the game by the scruff of the neck. And really, whoever it is, whether it's Amy Jones, whoever's down in shepherding that lower order, you have to take control of that situation and understand exactly what is required of you. Whether they do scenarios, I don't know, because they certainly don't play enough domestic cricket in England in the 50-over format. So nope. I'm sure that will be something that we'll come on to maybe when we go through some of the questions that we've had in.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah,
we've talked about the workload thing before. It's something that is a real bugbearer of mine about the amount of cricket you play, the more cricket you play, and it's not like it's a death-defying schedule. And the more cricket you play, the more aware I think you get of match situations, and it's all right doing it in practice, but there is nothing like doing it in a match situation when the pressure is on, and you know, being rested for this and rested for that, you know, they don't play a lot of cricket in the first place, and so I would take every opportunity I could, but that's just something that we're going over old ground, and I'll go off on one again, Lyd, and no one wants that. In the last one-day international just gone, Australia were 59 for 4. After 14.2 overs, they'd got rid of Phoebe Litchfield, Elise Perry, Alyssa Healy and Annabelle Sutherland. And then a partnership between Beth Mooney and Ash Gardner of almost 196 or 95, I think it was. And then Mooney got a half century, and then Ash Gardner and Talia McGrath put on over 100 as well, those two partnerships. Taking it to 257 for six when Gardner was out for her first one day international 100. And then this cameo, we've seen it before, Georgia Wareham, 38 not out off 12 deliveries, 5 fours, 2 sixes, go back to Southampton in the last Women's Ashes series where she took apart Lauren Bell. She took apart both Bell and Sophie Eccleston in this instance. And that, again, that really, is that the difference between them, victory and defeat in this game? Well, we've already said that there's numerous things, but that's another aspect of what Australia have in their depth and how dangerous they can be.
And how often do you see Sophie Eccleston's figures 1 for 76 off 10? I was so impressed when teams, because I've been in team meetings where you talk about Sophie Eccleston and how you're going to play against her as a batter. And I think Georgia Wareham, you should package up the way that she played Eccleston, because she never looked any squarer than extra cover, and she never looked any squarer than mid wicket. And I think if you can target those pockets with Sophie Eccleston, she's so hard to sweep, to play too square, either on the leg side or the offside. But Georgia Wareham, I thought, played her as well as anyone I've seen play Sophie Eccleston. But again, it just shows the depth that they have, doesn't it? Yeah. You leave out Darcy Brown and then you get Georgia Wareham coming into the side, and the way that she bowled,
Nat Silverbrunt and Tammy. So Tammy was 50-odd not out, Nat Silverbrunt, who was 60-odd not out, and she got both of them. A really good game for Georgia Wareham. On any other occasion, she probably would have been player of the match. But again, we talk about that depth and the quality Australia can turn to. But I think at the back end of England's bowling innings, I mean, it's never easy. But when you set in a field, I always say, good shot if, you know, the bowler bowls to that particular field and they hit it into an area that hasn't got a fielder there. Now, at that period of time, it's very difficult to watch because you're watching it on television, so you can't see the whole field, not like we can when we're on commentary anywhere.
Yeah.
But it was a predominantly leg side field. And, you know, Eccleston and Lauren Bell kept throwing it outside of off stump, or they made just that little bit of room. Now, if you are bowling a leg stump line and then the batter moves inside out and hits you over that, fair enough. That's a good shot. You've done what you're supposed to do with the ball. But they did offer it up. So into the hitting arc of the batters for Australia. So that was a little bit of a frustration at the back end of that innings. And then, as I say, England rolled for 222. Tammy got a little bogged down at the start. I don't think you can allow, I think it was something like 6 overs for 9 runs that Kim Garth bowled. I don't think in a power play situation you can allow a bowler to dictate that much. What I do like, Elisa Healy is up to the stumps to both shoot and Kim Garth.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, I understand that can be difficult for a batter, but you've got to find out a way. You know that's going to happen, so you've got to figure out a way. But even though that she did bowl well, she bowled nice and tightly, England had got themselves into a really good position. And really not kicking on from there. You know, worry for Alice Capshaw, she's not scored any, 0 off 2 today. Amy Jones looked good again, 30 off 26, but Danny Wyatt, 35 off 32. So these are good scores at a good rate. The partnerships they did start to put together, but as you mentioned, no one's really taking the game to the scruff of the neck. And in this against this opposition and in this Women's Ashes, that's what they needed to do today, being 2 games to 1 down. Okay, let's move on, because we've already spoken a lot about what's gone on, what's to come. T20 series lid. A lot of stuff that I heard post-match was they're looking forward to the change of format. I can completely understand that. And, you know, a few fresh faces perhaps into the side. What have England got to do? What have England got to do in this T20 series?
I think the change of format will help them. I think as we speak about, the this format brings teams closer together. I think the longer the format, the more you see any gaps or weaknesses in the team, which we've just seen with England. But I think for England, this will be, they will be saying, look, we can do this still. And of course they can. Like, yep. We can't write them off. We obviously can't. But I think we've just sort of aired some frustrations and observations, and we've shared our opinion on what we've seen in the first three games. But within that England group, they will be, and they have to be saying, we can win these next three T20s, because they won the White Ball series, the ODIs and the T20s in the most recent Ashes series. So there's no reason why they can't turn it around. They will need key players, I think, to get into form. It'll be interesting to see what they do with Alice Capsey, actually. Obviously, she was left out in the T20 11 against South Africa. Sophia Dunkley got the opportunity there. So that number three spot, I'd be interested to see who they go with, whether it is Alice Capsey, whether it's Sophia Dunkley. We're obviously wait to find out. I think Danny Wyatt being at the top of the order can inject a bit of momentum for them. And it'll be about players having to find some form, match winning form as well. Someone like Nat Sibber-Brunt, we saw a glimpse of that today. So I wonder whether that knock we've just seen today is just going to kickstart Nat and bring her into that form that we've seen. I'm sure Sarah Glenn will probably come in, would have thought. Yeah, bowlers wise, what do you think they'll do? Because Kate Cross will be fit, but she won't be playing in the T20 stuff, will she?
No, and I think they've got a pretty decent bowling formula for me, England in T20 cricket, where you've got the three spinners and bringing in Sarah Glenn, Charlie Dean, Sophie Eccleston. Now, what they do have to be very wary of is that Australia, it seems, in this one-day international, have worked out a way of playing the spinners. They're not going to get a huge amount of purchase off the surface, you wouldn't think, being fresh decks. And so if they have worked out a player and the spin doesn't work, then they're up against it. So I wonder if they're going to bring in, the all-rounders in that respect, so they've got options to turn to with the seamers. So I think Lauren Bell will play, Nat Sibber-Brunt obviously plays. Do you look at Danny Gibson? Do you look Freya Kemp as well, a left-handed option? So do they both play? Do you actually want to play three spinners and Heather Knight can be your fourth spinner? And do you want to play four potential seamers in both Freya Kemp and Danny Gibson? Is something that England need to talk about as to, because, like I say, the way that Australia have played spin so far, I would much prefer having out-and-out bowlers and then other options in case it ain't working. Because if it ain't working and you've got Alice Capsey and Heather Knight as your other go-to bowlers, then you're going to come up a little bit short. So I think there's a lot to be discussed regarding the team changes. Actually, just quickly nipping back, it was interesting as well about the usage of Sophie Eccleston in the one-day internationals. It was actually Michael Vaughan on social media. And it's interesting. Now, he doesn't watch a huge amount of the women's game, but here is one of England's best tactical captains, and he's sort of saying, why did England leave it so late to bring on Sophie Eccleston in one-day internationals? It was interesting. When did Australia bring on Ash Gardner? Right? 11th over. Immediately after the power play. It does make me wonder why England leave Eccleston. And for me, I think he's got a point. I would get, even if Australia are three down, get her on. She's number one in the world for that very reason. Get into that before they get allowed to get a start or to kick on in their innings. Get her on, because that's the one. She's the one bowler that I'm sure Australia do fear. That actually fear, and even though they've played her very, very well, there is a reason why she's number one in the world, and she is England's biggest threat. So anyway, the T20 series, as you say, when the game is shortened, it does bring a side closer together. It's a ridiculously, blindingly obvious thing to say, but England need to win the first one. They need to win all three to stay in the women's Ashes. But they need to win the first one, else the Ashes are gone. That's it. Yeah. Australia have 8 points and England can't win. So it is blindingly obvious, but I think it needs underlining three times. And they need to get that first win to build up some kind of momentum, to show that Australia aren't, you know, completely... or that there is some fallibility about this Australian side, but at the moment it doesn't look like there is.
But even when there has been, you know, weaknesses on show, there were drop catches from the Australians. They didn't always bowl as well as they could have done. Obviously, Annabelle Sutherland got taken off because of two dangerous deliveries.
Yeah.
They have had batting collapses, but they've still found a way to win games, and that's the sign, as a bigger cliche as it is, that's a sign of
a
world
class.
We do love a cliche, but that is a sign of a world class team. So yeah, these T20s, as we both say, captain obvious, and they have to start well. They have to win.
Right, let's bash through some questions that have come through. Now, a lot of these came in. Thank you for sending them, by the way, on social media. And you can always email us, daggersandlids@outlook.com. If there's any sort of diatribe that you would like to write to us, then please do. Gazanir's Camera has responded to my ask for questions, saying, has the seven-year gap closed at all? If not, is Claire Connor's position untenable? I've got to say, I don't think there's a huge amount to do necessarily with Claire Connor. In that, you know, she's been a huge advocate of bringing in more finance and bringing in more facilities and getting more funding. So I don't think that side of things is necessarily pertinent. But the seven-year gap, the gap between, has it closed at all?
Well, if we're judging on what we've just seen, I mean, yeah.
A gentle start to the questions. Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, it doesn't look like it's closing.
No.
We've always said Australia, because of the way they started in the women's game, because they're 3 years ahead, have really cashed in on that. You know, with the professionalism in the game, with the domestic structures, with all of these aspects. And again, they do seem that they're still 3 years ahead of everybody else. I don't think that's to say this, that the structure in England is a bad one. I think it's a good one. I think it's ever improving. And I think there's some mighty fine players in England. I really do. You know, but I don't think the gap has necessarily closed. Is that where you stand?
Yeah. And I also think we're not in the place now where we say, give England a couple more years. I think we've had a brilliant structure in place for a long enough time now for England to be on par with Australia. And it might come out in some of the other questions that we get, but I think domestically we have to find a way to create a real competitive environment. And you don't get that if your England players aren't playing in your domestic competitions, or at least finding some way to connect with your domestic sides. It doesn't help that we've had quite a lot of changes over the years to it, because when you look at Australia, you look at the rivalries they've got New South Wales against Victoria. That's an old age rivalry which has gone on for many, many years. But with changes in domestic structure, you don't always get that rivalry. But maybe we'll talk a bit more about that in some of the other questions. But yeah, it doesn't look like that gap is closing.
We may have already answered some of these questions, I will say, and my apologies if we have. And so I just wanted to give a nod to people who had got in touch with us and asked for questions. H Good 97 says, do you think the performance will change? England's performance will change during the T20s as they will rotate some of their current players. I think we've covered that pretty much. I am Paul Mister, or I am Mr. Paul. I think it's Paul, who says, what makes Australia another level above England in the field? Is it a talent issue? I think, again, we've sort of covered the fielding pretty much, Lids. But one thing you're adamant about, it is not a talent issue.
No, it's not. I think it's, what is it? I think you look at the profile of players coming through now in England, and Freya Kemp, I think, is a really good example. Freya Kemp is the profile of cricketer that we want coming through the domestic structure. She is strong, she's fit, she's an athlete. So gone are the years where if you just bat and you can't really field, you don't really offer much with the ball, you can hide at fine leg. That they are long gone now. Yeah. So the player profiles that I think the talent ID team are identifying have to be more in the mould of an athlete, I think. Hopefully that sort of answers the question a little bit, because then you can then be better in the field.
100%. And that's why I was horrific. Ian Ray says, I'm not surprised when you watch the players form that as you get selected to play for other comps like the WPL, for once put some youngsters in there. If they lose, so be it. Seems like we're putting most in there to win caps and not games. What about that, Lid? And the fact is, we mentioned about the, you know, we have mentioned some young blood that has been introduced into the side. But I do think a fair point is that there is an ICC, a World Cup or a World T20 or a Women's Ashes every year for the next 4 years. And I do see that the introduction of some players, you can't have, I don't think you can have a massive overhaul. I think it's got to be a gradual process because you still want to be competitive in these and just not thrust five uncapped players into your England side. Or maybe that's what it does need. I don't know. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I think at times England have missed a trick. With someone like Bess Heath, I think in South Africa, she didn't get any sort of game time at all. I think there could have been moments where she could have been given a go. And I think another example, actually, we've spoken a lot about the captaincy and who will come in after Heather goes. And if people remember, England went to Ireland at the back end of last summer, I think September time, and they made Kate Cross captain. Now, I think the thinking behind that would have been she's our most senior player. She deserves that opportunity to captain her side. But I think the more important way of looking at that is saying, OK, Heather Knight isn't going to play forever. Who can we give a leadership opportunity to who could potentially captain England one day? You know, someone like Grace Scrivens, Holly Armitage. Unfortunately, they're not quite good enough as cricketers yet to get into the England side. But I tell you what, they are very good leaders. And I think that's just an example where at times they've missed the opportunity to forward plan at a time where they're not too vulnerable within a series, if that makes sense.
Yep.
No, does that answer the question again? Sometimes I forget what these questions are. No. It's too early still, sorry.
Do you know what? I'm not going to add anything to that. I think it's brilliantly answered. So, nice work. So, Chris Lawton asks, it feels like despite increased investment in women's cricket, the England team have gone backwards in the last 5 years. Too heavily reliant on that Siva Brunt with the bat and Eccleston with the ball. Worrying times. And this is interesting because there are... genuinely, there are worried England fans out there. They're concerned about the side. Why are the new players coming through not able to make the step up? Again, it's something that we've talked about. That does genuinely, that does take time. And you know, it's like anything, I think, I'll quickly answer this, what I think, is that when you get introduced to a higher level of cricket, it will take some time to try and accommodate to that sort of level and understand what is expected and what you're up against. And sometimes you have a burst onto the scene, and then sometimes it soon after, when you get seen a little bit, you get found out in certain areas. Yeah. And you know, Sophia Dunkley is a good example in that she did burst onto the scene, and then a few sort of technique issues were highlighted, and she's gone back and worked on those. And the hope is for her is that she's gone back to domestic cricket, scored a truckload, changed her technique a little bit, and will be ready to come through. Now, that hasn't happened as yet. She has been introduced or reintroduced back into the England side, but not with a huge amount of success yet. Mm. But I think that, you know, it does take a little bit of time to make that step up to the international game. Icon Photo UK says it before and I'll say it again. For all the supposed depth in this country, too many players in this team are under no threat for their place and don't have a winning mentality, a dangerous combination. We have just covered all of that, but there's an on-running theme to the things that it seems folks are saying, especially England fans as well. we shall wait to see how the T20 series pans out. That is coming up very soon indeed, because this is a very condensed women's Ashes series. On Monday the 20th, so what's that? My watch hands are covering, it's the 17th. My watch hands were covering the date on my thing. So it's the 17th today. So 3 days' time. In Sydney, Australia and England lock horns in the first T20. They go to the Manuka Oval in Canberra 3 days later, and 2 days after that they are at Adelaide for the third before the day-night test in Melbourne. So we'll wait and see how it pans out. No doubt we shall get together once again after the conclusion of the T20s, unless any excuse to get together to chat the women's game. But that is probably a decent plan to have. And so that's pretty much it from the Women's Ashes perspective. Lots to still look forward to. And lots, I think, I genuinely still think, we talked about in our preview show, what England can expect, and we both thought Australia were overwhelming favourites, and I think I used the word optimistic. I think England still can be optimistic that they can put on a show in the T20s. Yeah. But again, so much cricket to play, we shall have to wait and see how it pans out. So I am here in Malaysia, because for the junior members hoping to make it to the England side, the Under-19 Women's T20 World Cup kicks off in earnest tomorrow. England are taking on Ireland. Good job I remembered that, isn't it?
There was a moment of panic in your face.
There was. Yes, England are taking on Ireland. But 16 teams are out here. There's a lot of prep work to do because there's so much. This one, and you were out in the first T20 Under-19 World Cup as well with me over in South Africa a couple of years ago. And it was, wasn't it, Lily? It was the most joyous tournament. I don't think you will see purer cricket than we watched in that first tournament. I love that the ICC have given this a big expanded 16 teams format. So last time out, and I'm sorry, I should get my notes with me. I've not brought them. They're in the other room. They're in my bedroom in the hotel.
Oh, you've got two rooms. Lovely.
I've got a penthouse suite. Yeah, something like that, but not really. I've got a little kitchen behind me.
Oh, lovely.
There you go. So if I want to make something, a cup of tea, there's my suitcase.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And there's my bass guitar that I've brought as well. To get a little plucking done when I've got the off day, just to relax the mind.
Nice.
But yeah, it was joyous, wasn't it? And the fact that last time out, we had the United States, there was Scotland, who one of the associate teams, there was else? Rwanda.
Yeah,
Zimbabwe. And Rwanda, brilliant that they managed to get, you know, wins against Zimbabwe, and they managed to beat the West Indies. And that's what it's about, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And the storylines that come with it as well. I'm intrigued, Agus. What's the conditions like out there? I mean, I doubt you've been able to get down to the grounds, but what can we expect?
So, it turns out that the sort of heavy monsoon season is from the end of November to the end of January. So it has been a little rainy. And I'm looking outside at the moment now, and it looks pretty grey and overcast, and there's a bit of rain in the air. And on a more serious note, there have been... I'm in Johor Bahru, which is the second biggest city in Malaysia. It's about 3 hours' drive south of Kuala Lumpur. And I've not been out at all. I've been in the hotel, got here late last night, early yesterday, and then slept a little bit, and I'm a lot fresher now than I was yesterday, a little dusty yesterday. But immediately, the thing that absolutely hit me is the humidity and how hot it was. Goodness me, it was steamy. And it kind of makes sense, really, because we're about 100 miles from the equator. It is going to be sort of energy-sapping conditions, even in T20 cricket. You're going to be tested here. The youngsters, good job they are young.
A little bit of swing on offer, maybe.
But I'll be intrigued to see what sort of pitches they're going to be playing on, whether they're going to be conducive to a little bit of turn, if there's going to be dew around. I know that, you know, there's no floodlights or anything, so there's going to be no day-night cricket, as you like, but with such a heavy air, it's going to make a little bit of difference. So I'm really excited because because it's a place we've never, or I'd say we, but I have never been, never covered cricket here. It's great, I think, that a tournament such as this is taken to countries that don't necessarily are, you know, are not test playing nations. So I love the fact the ICC have come back. It sounds like I'm, you know, sort of bigging up the ICC, but in this instance, I think they should have credit where it is due. And I think that who've we got coming this time? Samoa have qualified, and Nepal. Who else? Nigeria from Africa have qualified. Scotland again. So this is exciting for me. And you know, we know, and I say this with as much respect as possible, we know that some of the cricket's not going to be of international standard. That is not the point. It is not the point. When you get to the Super Six stage, when you get to the knockout stages, you know, the quality then sort of rises to the top, as you would expect. Of course Samoa are not going to give whoever a game, you know, England or Australia or India or whoever. No, but do you know what? They have earned the right to be here. And they've earned the right to learn and to get exposure and to, you know, play in a World Cup, which they have qualified for through the East Asia Pacific qualifiers. I think that's what it is. And I'm excited. And how proud they will be to be wearing their country's flag on their chests as they, you know, belt out the national anthem or whatever it is. I just think it's brilliant and what cricket should be doing as regards who I think is good. So all of tomorrow, we will get there to the ground at the Academy Oval in Johor, see what the form is. We've not been down today. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait. And, you know, they're using four different areas, one in Kuala Lumpur, one over in an island just close by near Singapore. So it's going to be thrilling. It really will be. And how thrilled we get about seeing young players, whether they be men or women, young players coming through, seeing what sides have got, who will rise, who will be the standout player, what's the future? Because a lot of these players, Lydia, and Ireland, who we see tomorrow, you know, they've played in full international games. And a lot of the Irish side were actually involved 2 years ago. That I think it's seven or eight of them who were involved. So this is good stuff. I really get excited about seeing it. I do expect to see the usual suspects in the final sort of four. You know, the big three, you know, South Africa and New Zealand and maybe the West Indies, you know, so that I think we'll get to that. Let's see what's out there. Let's learn a little bit about the girls that are playing, learn their personalities, see what talent they have, and you know, I'm sure you'll be excited to see some of it as well.
I will. Well, you have to keep us updated. We do some pods over the next few weeks, and you can feed back to us. You can be our intel on the ground. That'll be great.
I shall try. And we've got a super little commentary team here as well. In HD Ackerman's over, great man, Marina Iqbal and Isabel Joyce. So former Pakistan and the Ireland internationals as well. So we're going to have some good fun. That's what we are going to do. We're going to have some good fun. You will be hugely missed out here, but you're of course not here for very good reason. But there'll be lots more on the Under 19 Women's T20 World Cup on our next podcast as well. Lids, thanks for getting up so early. Thank you to all of you for your questions as well. Keep them coming in. We do see all the comments. If you want to get in touch with either myself or Lydia on X, we are Lydia Greenway and Charles Dagnall. That's not all one handle. She has her own handle. I have mine. Or same on Instagram for me, at Charles Dagnall. Or if you want to get in touch with us via email, daggersandlids@outlook.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. And we'll see you next time.